Hi, I'm Margot Martindale, the host of Foreign Policy's new podcast, I Spy. Spies don't talk. It's one of the rules of the business. But here at Foreign Policy, we get them to open up. Each week, one former operative from somewhere around the world tells the story of one dramatic mission. Subscribe to I Spy wherever you get your podcasts.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, the Syrian filmmaker who risked her life to document what really happened in Aleppo. The Syrian civil war that erupted in 2011 and continues to this day is one of the world's deadliest conflicts. An estimated 400,000 people have died in the fighting, many of them in brutal assaults carried out by the forces of President Bashar al-Assad. Over 6 million Syrians are now refugees.
13 million people in Syria are believed to be in dire need of humanitarian aid. The war is also affecting healthcare in Syria. An estimated 1.5 million people have been left with permanent disabilities, and it's uncertain.
One major flashpoint has been the northern city of Aleppo, where rebel forces held out for years. In 2016, the Assad regime, backed by Russian forces, set siege to the city for 6 months.
The bombs don't discriminate. And the fighting for Aleppo is now so intense that the Turks say up to 30,000 Syrian refugees are now camped out along their border.
Wada Khatib was a 20-year-old student when the protests began in 2011. She spent the next 5 years filming the conflict in Aleppo and documenting the impact of the war on civilians. That footage became the basis for the documentary For Sama, named for her daughter. It will be broadcast on Frontline this month. Al-Khatib is our guest on First Person this week. Wad, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So your film is so powerful, and it's really stayed with me for the last few days. But I want to go back, as you do in the film. Tell me where you were born.
I was born in Aleppo. And I lived all my life until 2016 when we forced to flee.
And you were a student in Aleppo?
Yes, I was.
What were you studying?
I was doing marketing economics at Aleppo University when the revolution started, when I switched everything to do media.
And were you paying attention to the what came to be called the Arab Spring around the world?
Yes, a lot. And before the revolution, we've never thought that this is what happened in our country. Even when we were watching Tunisia and Egypt, we thought that this is could be something so hard in Syria to start. But suddenly we start watching some of the channels, putting some material from Daraa and Damascus. And we felt that, no, this is now real and this is happening. So we were just part of this.
Tell me about the first protests in Aleppo.
The first one, I was at my college and I heard kind of voice about, it's just like echo. And I couldn't really believe that this is a protest against the regime. But I was I'm hearing this, but is it real? Is it something I'm just imagine this? So I was running toward that sound. And when I arrived, there was maybe less than 20 students who were chanting God, Syria, and only freedom. And just that hope and amazing feeling, it just stayed for, I don't know, maybe just 2 minutes when I've started seeing security forces coming to beating the student and arresting them. This was the first one I've seen, and I couldn't really chant. I couldn't do anything. I was just freezing in my place. And it was just as a dream, and you've seen it, that this is real now. So the second protest, I heard about it from friends, and we joined them from the beginning. But at that time, the longest protest doesn't exist more than 5 minutes.
And why were they so short?
Because the security forces were everywhere, so you can't really do anything. They were just trying to control all the places at Aleppo University, to not make people see that there's people against the regime and there's people who's protesting. And that's why filming this, even if it was like 30 seconds or 1 minute or 2 minutes, it was just something so important to tell the people inside and outside that this is happening and people here protesting and there's a revolution against the regime.
And remind our listeners what year that was.
It was 2011, March. The first one I've seen was in April 2011. And since that time, like, we had some time in Aleppo University where there was 5 protests a day. It could be everyone just like 3-4 minutes. But, you know, like, people were just trying so hard to make that happen.
And you took your camera out immediately.
It was first my phone, as many other activists, because just like being there was a crime, filming that was more crime. So it's just like you need anything in very easy way to not make any attention to you that you are filming this. So we started doing this with our phones. And then I got a camera from a friend and I was putting that camera. It was like Sony hand cam. It's so like not good one at all, but at that time was so professional to have that camera. So I was putting this all the time into my bags and I make a small hole in all my bags so I can film through my bag without taking the camera off.
Because you were at risk if they saw you filming.
Of course, yeah. They will arrest you. They could kill you if they found that you are recording these things.
What did you do with that first footage?
Unfortunately, because I was so excited about that, the first few months when I started filming that, I showed them to my cousin who is more knowing more than me about these things. At that time, you can't show anyone's face, so all the footage should be from the back of these people. So I was so proud of that footage, and I showed them to my cousin when he told me, like, no, what? This is not working. You can't chant and film at the same time. You need to decide. Even you are a protester or you are a filmmaker, so you can't do both. And I was like, no, I can't do this. Like, I want to be part of this, and I can't be not exciting enough to say things where I'm filming.
Very soon after that first footage, you show an extremely upsetting, extremely disturbing image of a number of people being pulled out of the river who have been, it appears, have been executed.
Yeah.
When was that?
That was the first month of 2013. It was 2 years after the revolution started. And that's when we realized that this is not just some month. This is could be very long. This is could be like not easy at all. And we knew that from the beginning because at the first protest when regime started to beat people, arrest them and kill them in a very direct way. But we didn't thought that this could be like executed people and throw them in a river.
Did your fellow students, did people start to leave Aleppo?
There was 2 parts of Aleppo, the east part where it was out of the regime control. At the first of 2000 or the end of 2012, people fled this area because the regime started to shell this area with a mortar. Mm-hmm. But then after a while, people start to come back to their houses because they felt that this could be so long. So people start to come and a new life start to exist in east part of Aleppo.
So throughout this time, you are holding your camera. What are you documenting at the beginning?
At the beginning, I felt that this is so strange situation and so new for us. There's part of the city which is out of the regime control. There's no hospitals, no schools. People just start to be back and start open their jobs again. And through that, there's like shelling and bombing to this area. So I felt it was just like so strange place where you need to find a way to make this city works. That's why like Hamza and our friends set up a hospital. Another friend start to do schools for the children who are living in that situation. And I felt that this is something important to document because this is the first chance for us to say that this is our life here and we can go with this. We can do our life better, even if it's under shelling and bombing.
Introduce us to Hamza Al-Khadib.
Hamza was a student at Aleppo University. He was just graduated in February 2012. So when we met, it was during the protests as a friend, as many other people. And then our relationship started to be more closer when we moved to east part of Aleppo. We've lived in the same hospital. He was a doctor and he was the manager of that hospital. And I was just a girl living there because the hospital could be a good place for me because I was just coming alone to east part of Aleppo. I don't have family. I don't have people who I know before. So the hospital could be a place where I can stay and live with the nurses who living there. So we've met together and we start like our relationship as many other people. And with the time, we felt in love. And after a while, like we realized that this is the life where we stuck in. It could be forever. So why we just waiting? Why we don't start set up our family in this place? And that's when we decided to get married.
What year was that?
2014, December.
When you say he decided to set up a hospital, where did he get the materials?
At the beginning, it was just like one room as a clinic and six rooms where they're just like beds. And there was just Hamza and another doctor and five staff, one midwife and four nurses. It wasn't really a hospital, really, but there was a place where people can come if anything happened for them to take the first aid. With the time when another organization started to be in Aleppo, like MSF, SAMS, SEMA, and SRD, these organizations started to bring material and medical supports for these places, and they became like more proper hospital.
Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders you mentioned, what are the two other organizations?
SRD. Syrian American...
I just saw that. It's Syria Relief and Development.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. SRD. And in the film you narrate how Hamza actually was a part of the protests as well as being a doctor.
Yeah.
Was he the only person in that space or were there other doctors like that?
There was other doctors, but he was more involved in the activist work. Most of the doctors there, they thought that their work should be more focused on the medical situation, while Hamza was both between like being an activist and doing the medical job.
When the protests begin, you're a student. Tell me about how regular life began to change around you.
It became something not related anymore with your personal life. It became more in the public. Everything you was planning to your personal life, to your like career or to your family or anything, it's just like you cancel everything. You are part of this big movement and anything you will think about, it's all related to that one. I think because we've seen a lot of people who've been killed in front of our eyes. So just like there's no return in this way. You need to be involved to the end of that story. And there's no time really to think about what I want to do as Wad, as a person.
It seems in the film, very early on, the casualties that come in to the hospital are often children. And you document that throughout. How did you decide to show those images?
It's so hard from the beginning when I get out of Aleppo and I was so terrifying that people here doesn't want to see this material because they are sheltered in one way or another about being part of this horror, let's say. So I was so scared because I felt when I was filming this and I know that in any part of the story, I could be instead of these injured people. It could be my daughter, it could be my husband. So for us, when channels and organization outside said like, no, we can't show this material, this is so hard for us because if people hasn't seen this, if people doesn't know what war really means, that's not solved the problem, you know? If they didn't see this picture, this is, doesn't mean that this is not happening. It's just like so far and people are away from this. While if people see in this picture and understand these circumstances, that could be part of the solution. That could be part of the action that people need to take to understand that this is behind this war. There's families, there's children, and there's, like, you know, the bombing and all these things. People sometimes say that, oh, yeah, Assad is good for his people. You can't find more better than him. Well, when you've seen this, when you've seen that this cost is not just about money, it's not just about fighters, it's not just about destroying buildings. It speaks about life, about future.
We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Margo Martindale, the host of Foreign Policy's new podcast, I Spy. Spies don't talk. It's one of the rules of the business. But here at Foreign Policy, we get them to open up. Each week, one former operative from somewhere around the world tells the story of one dramatic mission. Subscribe to iSpy wherever you get your podcasts.
You mentioned that your normal life sort of ceased to exist. You didn't live a normal life anymore, but in the middle of it, you have a wedding, which you film. What was it like to hold a wedding during this?
This was part of the fighting for our life, just to try to be in a normal life. That was part of the great things that give us a lot of resilience and give us a lot of hope that we need to continue this, even if we don't know really what will happen next. But this is kind of stay very strong. So the wedding was so simple and so easy, and it was so lovely. But at the same time, we were so scared that this is beautiful dream could be ended at any moment with any shelling or any bombing. But still, like, until now, when I remember that, when I'm looking back now to that material and that footage, I feel that we were so strong, really. It doesn't matter what happened later. It was all about the moment itself, when you knew that your life could be ended at any moment, but you knew that you are alive now. So now I will celebrate my victory that I'm still alive until now.
And many of the doctors and nurses around you, you show them on screen and then they're gone.
Yeah, this is part of the true life. Even when I was filming, I wasn't sure that if I would make it or not. I was pretty sure that I would be killed at any moment. And that's one of the things that would make me keep filming, even if I was so tired or exhausted or I don't have any hope why I'm doing this. That's life in that situation. It wasn't forever, you know, like the main things which we were saying in our life that I hope when I will be killed, I will not be like stuck under the rubble for like hours. Or I know if I will be killed, I wish like we can be me and Hamza together, not one of us watching the other. It was the same thing when I'm looking at Sama, that I don't know what will happen, but I wish that anything could happen for all of us, and none of us will stay alive to watch the others like suffering or continue in that bad situation.
It's something that's very remarkable and very hard to watch in your film, which is all the loved ones who are left behind. There's a scene in one moment relatively early in the film where three brothers come in. One has been killed and the other two survive the bombing. And you see the trauma on the two. They're all small boys.
Yeah.
You became pregnant with Sama, your daughter, what year?
In 2015, March.
And how did it feel to you to become pregnant in the midst of all this?
Like, when we got married, we decided at the beginning that we don't want to bring a child to this place. We just want to be together, me and Hamza. We will start set up our new family, and we will think about that later. But maybe 2 months later, we were like sitting together, have that conversation, very real and serious conversation about, okay, so what next? What we are waiting for? And we both have a lot of hope for the future, and we are sure that these things will give us more resilience and more love and more life. So let's do it, and that's it. And 1 month later, I was pregnant with Sama. Before Sama, I knew that I stuck in the revolution because I knew that I'm fighting for a better future for all of us. But when Sama was real, it was more reason to keep fighting. And one of the moments which still in my mind until now, when I was out filming rubbles of one of the big buildings where there was people under these rubbles and there was the white helmet trying to rescue these people. I was filming and I was so emotional about this, but I remember exactly how Sama's feet was like kicking me inside. And I really put my hand on my tummy and I was like, yeah, like they will make it and I will make it and we will be all brought alive. And it just like I was stronger than everything around.
Now bring us to the siege of Aleppo. When did it begin?
July 2016.
And how old was Sama at this point?
She was 6 months.
And how did the siege begin?
We've been threatened to be besieged for more than 1 year and a half. And you can see that in the film because before the siege, I was interviewing a child who was speaking about we are afraid that the siege could happen. So in July, like 10 days before that happened, we left from Aleppo to Turkey. to see Hamza's father who had cancer. So we were there when we heard that the regime is so close now and the road could be cut off at any moment. And when we heard that, we were like, just want to be back because our life all in Aleppo. So we took Sama and we had quick discussion with Hamza's parents about leaving Sama with them and just go alone or taking Sama. And we've just decided, no, we will take Sama and we will come back. And we went back in the last day before the regime like take the whole area.
Let's pause on this for a moment. You're in Turkey and you are in relative safety.
Yeah.
You hear the siege is coming and you decide to return to Aleppo. What was the motivation?
Like the main thing is that this is our life. We knew that we belong to that place. We know also that we weren't alone. There was 300,000 civilians who were living in Aleppo. All of these families where we lived with them for 5 years. We experienced with them all the bad moments and also all the great moments. Hamza wasn't just a doctor. And just being a doctor, this is a big responsibility. And we knew in that situation that any doctor could make a real difference in that situation. But also he was the manager of the hospital. And people, when they will feel that he abandoned them, he stayed out and left them in that situation, they will be so broken. So we felt just like we need to be back at any situation. And I'm not going there just to stay. I have a job to do. I have a camera. I have a big responsibility that I can document. I have a great relationship with the channels outside. So I can be part of the voice of the people who are living in that circumstances. So we've just took Sama and went back.
And you had to walk across the border.
Yeah. There was like we almost knew that the regime is controlling the area. So there was no possible for any car to go through that way because they were attacking the car very easily. So we've been advised that in some area we need to walk through the fields. And we did it. Like we were me, Hamza, and Sama. And we had another doctor with his wife and another journalist. And we crossed that area and we arrived to Aleppo safely.
Tell me how life changed under the siege versus before.
We knew that the siege will come. So most of the families in the city were have kind of storage and some of the material which could be stay for a long time. We were cut off from all the fruit and vegetables and anything could be really fresh to eat. So we wasn't like really have hunger, but we were also in very bad situation as a bodies because you need a lot of vitamins, you need a lot of things to be really strong. And you will see in the film in one shot when I was filming Salem and Afra, the other family, the kind of the food that we have. It's all like it can't be used, but we need to use it. We don't have other option.
She's washing rice and yeah. There are bugs that are crawling in the rice itself.
Exactly. But you don't have other choice. You need to eat this because if you didn't eat it, there's no other choice. And also the big things start happening when the regime started to attack all the hospitals in the area, where there was 9 hospitals and 8 of them were completely destroyed. And that was 3 months after the beginning of the siege. And that's when our hospital, Al-Quds Hospital, became the last hospital in the area. So it got all the attention and it got all the more risk because there was no other hospital. So we need to protect it more and we need just to keep working in that circumstances. The other thing that the siege, you don't know how long it will be. So even if you have like supplies or a lot of material, you need to take a lot of hard decision and sometimes about some of the medicine or some of the supplies that you have to make it stay long as much as it could be.
The majority of casualties, the wounded that come in, are they mostly civilians?
Yeah, most of them civilians. Like in Aleppo, there was 300,000 people. And the fighters, I don't know really exactly number of that, but it's maybe like 10,000 or something. So it's just a little bit. Most of the people who live in this area is from the area itself. And there's like a lot of families and women. And you can realize this in the film itself. when I was like going out or inside, you can see like how many men are, but how many women and children and just normal people who are living their life there.
How are the children handling the siege?
Every child has his own life and his own world. For me, like, for example, Asama especially, she wasn't really react as any normal child. When she heard a very loud voice, she wasn't really like, look at the place or something. She seems that she understands everything and she reacts like an adult. And sometimes she's being just like the normal child. It really like break your heart because you don't know what to do. You don't know what she's understanding. You can't even like speak with her and express herself in any way. The world is not the place where a child should be.
You are broadcasting your videos and you note in the film, sometimes a million people have watched a video, but you were disappointed with international reaction.
Yeah. Unfortunately, like we haven't seen or heard anything from the UN or the other organization where they should protecting us more than when we heard from them when they said you need to leave or you must leave. Like they were abandoning us a lot. And we've been left in this battle against the regime and the Russian forces. We were just like normal civilians living in that situation. Great doctors who working amazing job. Great white helmets people and civil defense people who's doing their best to rescue people. And just the world was watching all these brutal massacres and brutal violence that we've been crushed at. And just watching. When they interfered to help, they were implementing the Russian plan to take the area more than protecting the civilians who were there.
Did you see evidence of chemical weapons use?
In Aleppo, we don't have the chemical weapon that they said it's the sarin. Mm-hmm. But we've witnessed in our eyes every day at night, especially in the last 15 days, there was a chlorine gas attack. We've seen children who's like just almost died because of this chlorine gas. And you can smell it very clearly. And there's many organizations who document this and took some of this evidence out. This was something I was so terrifying of being in that situation. But just part of the big situation in Aleppo.
How long did the siege last?
6 months.
And in the end, you note that in the film, the UN reaches you and says it's time to leave.
Yeah.
What did that feel like?
It was the most shocking and difficult situation in everything, more than all the horror and the suffering that we've seen, because we had a chance to leave before, and everyone has a chance to leave. But we stayed because this is our country, and this is the place where we need to be. And instead of the world interfere to help us or to protect us, to make at least a ceasefire. They were just implementing the Russian and the Assad regime plan to control the area. And they were forced us to flee. There was no other option for us to stay, except if we want like really to be killed very easy way by the Assad forces. And they were just like, yeah, you need to leave now because if you didn't, the Russia and Assad forces will come in to take over all Aleppo and there will be a big massacres. So we left all. Like, there was a negotiation between the Russian and the Turkish government to make us out. And the UN was the people who they helped them to make that happen.
You were among the very last to leave the city.
Yeah.
What did the city feel like? What did it look like?
This is one of the hard things to speak about or to watch until now in the film. When you've seen that all these places where you were in many, many times, it's just empty. There's no life in the city anymore. Also, there's some of the hard things when we knew that we are leaving now. And there's many of our friends who've been killed through these years. And they were like buried in this ground. And you've just left them. The fact that we knew that we don't know when we will be back. And we don't know if we will be back or not. So you need to say goodbye to everything. Even like you are not sure that you will make it out and you will be survived because even this displacement wasn't protected for people. You will see in the film at the first convoy who left the city, the Russian sniper attacked the people who were in the first convoy.
Where did you go?
We went to Idlib. the last area now out of the regime control, where now it's the same situation exactly as we lived in Aleppo. There's more than now 3 million civilians who are living in Idlib city, which is northwest of Syria. And this area now, it's under the regime and the Russian attacks again. More than 50 health facilities being targeted in the last 3 months. I don't know, the situation is still like happening the same and exactly the same. And the world's still watching until now.
Where did you end up? You had a second child.
I was pregnant when I left Aleppo. And because Hamza is a doctor, so we have permission to cross the Turkish border. So we left to Turkey where our families were. We lived there for 1 year and a half. And then we moved to the UK where I was working at Channel 4 News. And I get asylum there and we live now there.
You said in the film the trauma will stay with you forever.
We will never find a peaceful life in our court. And not just thinking about us, but there's 6 million refugees around the world. I don't know the number even, and no one knows how many people are still in Assad prisons until today. And here in the USA, people have seen 11,000 pictures from Caesar Pictures from people who were tortured to death in Assad prisons. And there's more and more there. No one knows how much the real numbers. If we couldn't find any kind of accountability or justice, like this is can't be a world where we can live.
Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
That was Wadaa Khatib. Her award-winning documentary, For Sama, will be broadcast on Frontline this month. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with help from Benjamin Soloway and Anise Modi. Our editor is Ram Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcast is Dan Efron. If you like this episode, please share it, tweet about it, talk about it, and subscribe. And come back next week. We'll have a new episode.
Hi, I'm Margot Martindale, the host of Foreign Policy's new podcast, I Spy. Spies don't talk. It's one of the rules of the business. But here at Foreign Policy, we get them to open up. Each week, one former operative from somewhere around the world tells the story of one dramatic mission. Subscribe to iSpy wherever you get your podcasts.